Magnus Sigvardsson. Pitt spoke the name softly, accenting each syllable. Brother of Bjarn. Marlis sighed thoughtfully. There is a saga that mentions Bjarn Sigvardsson along with several boatloads of colonists setting off from Greenland toward the west. Later sagas claim Sigvardsson and his people were swallowed up by the sea and never seen again. The other 34 stones, said Pitt, what do they reveal? Most of them seem to be boundary markers. Magnus was quite ambitious. He claimed a quarter of what became the United States for his brother Bjarn and his tribe. And where were the other runestones found? Asked Kelly. The first and last was discovered at Crown Point on the southern end of Lake Champlain. Stone inscriptions were also found on a meandering course through Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas, and Kansas. The farthest stone was found by a Boy Scout troop near Sterling, Colorado. Kelly looked puzzled. I'm unclear as to what you mean by the first and last stone. As close as we can tell, the Lake Champlain runestone was the first inscribed at the beginning of the expedition. When they returned nearly a year later, they made a second inscription on the stone below the first. May we see them? Pitt asked. Marlis typed on her keyboard, and a large stone appeared on the monitor. Above 10 rows of inscriptions was carved the petroglyph of a Viking ship, complete with sails, oars, and shields on the sides. This is a tough one, said Marlis. None of the epigraphists who studied the stone have agreed 100% on the message, but the translations are fairly similar in text. She then began to translate the lengthy inscription. After 6 days' travel up the fjord from our families at the settlement, Magnus Sigvardsson and his 100 comrades rest here and claim all the land within sight of the water for my kinsman and leader of our tribe, Bjarn Sigvardsson, and our children. The land is far larger than we knew. We are well provisioned, and our 5 small ships are stout and in good repair. We will not come back this way many months. May Odin protect us from the Skraelings. She went on. I must warn you that the translations are very vague and probably do not convey the original meaning. The second inscription, carved on the return, reads, 14 months after leaving our families, we are but a few days' sail down the fjord to the cave below the high cliffs to our homes. Of the 100, we are now 95. Bless Odin for protecting us. The land I claimed in my brother's name is larger than we have known. We have discovered paradise. Magnus Sigvardsson. Then there is a date of 1036. 6 days' sail down the fjord, Pitt repeated pensively. That would suggest the Norsemen had a settlement in the United States. Has a site ever been discovered? Asked Jordino. Marlis shook her head. Archaeologists have yet to find one below Newfoundland. Pitt looked at Kelly. Your father knew where it was. What makes you say that? Why else would he become so fanatical in his search for the runestones? My guess is that he was searching for the cave mentioned in the final inscription. The reason he suddenly dropped his research is because he must have found it. Down in the lavishly furnished basement conference room at Tohono Lake, 6 men and 2 women sat opposite one another around a circular conference table. The 9th person, Curtis Merlin Zale, was seated at one end. He passed out several leather-bound folders and leaned back in his chair. "Commit what you read to memory," he directed. "When we leave tomorrow evening, all paperwork and notes will be destroyed." It was vital to the interests of the Cerberus Empire that the strategy planning session be held in the strictest secrecy. The men and women seated at the table were CEOs of the largest oil companies in the Northern Hemisphere and had congregated to map strategy for the coming months. "You all know the predictions," said Zale as he began the meeting. "Between 1975 and 2000, the world's population grew 50%. The demand for crude oil followed suit. By 2010, the world's total oil production will peak, From then until 2050, production will drop to a small fraction of what it is today. The 46-year-old head of Zena Oil, Rick Sherman, led the nation's third largest oil producer, third only to the parent company Cerberus, peered at Zale through thick, rimless glasses. "Statistics are already coming up short. A permanent oil shortage has begun 10 years ahead of the predictions. Production, which will skid steeply from now on." Jesus Morales, the CEO of the Caltex Oil Company, said, "Prices will skyrocket, accompanied by hyperinflation and even rationing. I shudder to think what level transportation costs will hit." "I agree." Sally Morse polished her reading glasses and studied Zale's report. The chief of Yukon Oil, Canada's largest oil producer, she'd been the last to reluctantly join the secret cabal 5 years earlier, but she was beginning to have second thoughts. "There will be no major finds in the future. As these fields diminish oil and gas, prices will rise on a steep curve."
"It's as though the entire situation were falling into our hands," said Zale. "By pooling our resources, our fields and refineries in North America, we can dictate our own terms. We can also double production by drilling where the government has not allowed us to go before. Our new pipeline systems will carry the oil overland without the expensive use of tankers. If our strategy works, the only oil and gas sold north of Mexico will be American and Canadian. To put it in simple terms, 96% of the income will go to enhance the profit of our respective organizations."